You're listening to the Builderpedia podcast, the only podcast that takes you on the whole property journey, from planning, design, building, selling, and everything in between. Along the way, we'll introduce you to our network of friends and colleagues who are experts in their field. Now, here are your hosts, Matt and Jeannie from Ballast Point.
Hello and welcome back to another exciting episode of Builderpedia. And today we're joined by a very special guest, James Rutherford from Structure Engineer, an engineer in Roselle, right down the street from us. We do bump into them all the time and we work together. So we certainly can recommend them as engineers and professionals. So hi, James. How are you going? Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
The reason we had you on, you know, everyone's talking about this house collapse in Southwest Sydney has become topical, and I couldn't help myself. I had to get someone to help me talk through it. Yeah, we're trying to keep on the topic that people are interested in, but would you like to just give us a bit of background on Structure?
Yeah, so it started off about 6 to 7 years ago now, and originally there was just three of us. So there was Rob, myself, and Mike, and over the years, we've grown, and there's now six of us all up. So we mainly specialize in structural engineering on residential properties. So we can do everything from, you know, the multi-million dollar houses, you know, the new builds out in the eastern suburbs, to the small wall removals. And the great thing about residential engineering is you're always seeing new things, always learning new things. So,
like this week with a brand new house that's sort of fallen on its side, and that's a new thing that I didn't expect.
But, definitely a new thing, yeah.
Yeah, so we normally just start with a little bit of an icebreaker, and so we want to talk about something or someone who's inspired you. So have you got someone in mind that you wanted to share?
The one inspiration that kind of came to me, and I think it's a constant really, is one of my colleagues here in the office. He's the office guru. You know, he's the go-to guy when you need a question, because he's been in the industry for so long. Mike is definitely my inspiration. I'm sure he's a few of the other guys' inspiration here as well.
Can you think of like a key surprising thing that you learned from Mike that you didn't expect or you didn't know that really surprised you and took you in a different direction?
I think the best advice that I was given was, you know, if you ever make a mistake, don't turn up to site pretending like you haven't, right? Because the moment you start doing that, you're just making the problems worse. The best thing to do is to go face the builder and go, right, yep, we've made an error here. What can we do to fix it?
Yeah, I agree with that. The irony of that is that the outcome is so much better for you being the party in the wrong if you just put your hand up and go, okay, I've made a mistake. It disarms everyone. Everyone starts cooperating.
But most importantly, it helps things move forward. You know, otherwise you're going around in circles, and if anything, you're just making things worse, really.
Yeah. So my inspiration is like the total like tangent of like it couldn't be more removed. I'm listening to an audiobook that's called Faith, Hope and Carnage by Nick Cave and Sean O'Hagan. And it surprised me. I just picked it up as a, hey, this could be interesting. I love Nick Cave, but yeah, really, really surprised me. I got some incredible insights on the creative process and life. Like it's a phenomenal read. The thing I didn't even know is that Nick Cave is very religious. I mean, he's sort of like the Dark Lord, but he admits to being quite a religious person. And, you know, and I don't identify as religious, but it was quite interesting his take on the whole matter and just his honesty, and it's quite incredible, and just the process that he's been through. He lost a son and at one point, and if you have kids, and you can totally identify with that journey. I mean, I haven't lost any kids. But it's certainly an incredible read, and he's so open and honest about all the things that he's completely stuffed up and got wrong, as well as all the triumphs and all the things that he loves in his life. So yeah, I don't know. I kind of thought I'd try it, but try the book. But a very interesting read. But there was a particular part about the creative process that was just that applies to anyone anywhere. Anyway, moving from one really interesting and triumphant, terrible seg. I'm not even going to try and segue. I'm going to just say, hey, why we got James is because it's funny. All of Sydney's talking about this house that's kind of fallen on its side a little bit at one end, and it keeps coming up in conversation. So, and I sort of had a look at some of the photos that have come out of it, some of the drone photos. And as I joked previously, it's like seems to be the most photographed house in Sydney at the moment. Everyone's taken selfies there's all sorts of photos of it. There's drone shots, there's video. But, you know, we don't really know what happened, but I can definitely see some things that were very wrong with it. And I think, James, you can probably give us some insights into what you think happened and why, because people are interested to know if their own house is going to fall over.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, it's one of those things that all we can do is speculate, based off the pictures that we've seen and then form our own opinions. Obviously, there's the proper parties involved who are doing their investigations as we speak and picking through the rubble and just trying to figure out what happened. But there would have been a number of things to occur. To fail for this collapse to occur, really, it wouldn't just be one thing, I don't think.
So one thing I can see from the photo clearly is one thing that stands out is there's a brick wall that's obviously fallen over and is just laying these bits of wall on the ground. Then there's what seems to be quite a pristine timber-framed wall where you could see the vapor barrier on it. And one thing missing, obviously, and I'm just wondering if you agree, there's no wall ties. There's a brick wall that's fallen. And I guess just in terms of brick, what a brick veneer is, a timber stud wall and a brick wall. And it's only a veneer when it's stitched together, right? Otherwise, it's just two separate walls. So what I can see is a complete lack of wall ties on the timber stud wall. It's all very neat. There's a little tear in halfway through. And from what I can tell, it's, that wall's pristine. It's not like wall ties have been ripped out of anywhere. It's just someone just didn't put them in at all. So that's the main thing. And so when you have a wall that's not a veneer wall anymore, it's just two walls, so it's a very tall brick wall that's just flapping in the breeze a little bit. And brick walls were never designed to be built that tall without sort of lateral support. So obviously that's one thing I can see that's definitely out of place, that you can spot. You just go, something not right as a builder. I wonder if you agree with that.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. That was one of the things I noticed too. I couldn't see any ties in there. And it's exactly as you say. If there's no ties, they're just acting as two separate walls. And brickwork on itself isn't particularly great. You do need to restrain it on all sides, so top, bottom, and obviously to the stud wall. So that does make the brickwork inherently weaker, really, when it's not restrained properly and not tied to the stud wall like it should be. I guess just talking about the walls too, another thing that you would need in a structure like that, I did a bit of research and I managed to find photos of what the house looked like before the collapse. And the thing that I noticed is you've got the garage structure underneath, And then on top, you got the first floor bedrooms, I'm assuming, and it's got a cantilevered balcony. And when you look at that structure as a whole, you know, the first thing the engineer needs to have a look at is, you know, we've got living areas on top of a large open space underneath, right? And when you've got a large open space like a garage, the most critical thing you need to make sure is that those walls are all properly braced. So tying it to the brickwork's one thing, but also making sure that the whole structure is laterally braced. So if any wind load or external force may hit it, that all those loads go down to the ground pretty much. So I look at that and I think that's obviously another area of concern as to, you know, was it adequately braced around that the walls in the garage there? Was it adequately braced at the first floor? You know, because there's that cantilever too that's playing a big part in all of this as well. So it's really hard to say what was happening there.
Yeah, but there's no – that whole upper floor is slumped. So it doesn't look like it was sitting on any sort of a column or it looks like it was probably sitting on brickwork. So probably, you know, I guess if you create a steel beam and a steel column and you connect them adequately, then that probably gives you enough bracing if the steel's big enough. But in that case, it just seemed like it was sitting on a brickwork. The brickwork became quite unstable and flopped. The whole thing flopped.
That's right. That's right. And you brought up a good point, actually, because with cantilevered structures, whenever we design a floor to cantilever, especially like the one on this property that collapsed, we tend to frame the whole thing out of steel. And any beams that go over a wall, they have a steel column. That way you know that everything's quite a rigid connection. But most importantly, you want to make sure that all that framing for the cantilever is going back to something that's tied down, right? Because obviously the line of the garage door is going to be where your hinge point's going to be and where the structure would want to obviously go over. So there's a few things that really you need to carefully design and take into account to make sure that everything's going to be fine, especially when you've got a cantilever over a large open space like that. So it could also be the fact that maybe the structure at the back of the garage that was restraining that cantilever balcony, you know, something could have failed there as well. You know, it's quite difficult to say, but generally with structures like that, you do want to frame them in steel or you want to frame them in concrete. Timber inherently just it's not good for big cantilevers just because, as you know, it will just deflect over that line of support and push upwards, if that makes sense, you know, because the cantilever then wants to go down.
Yeah, and in terms of like just the bigger picture of it, because, you've got a lot of layers of compliance. So how do you prevent this sort of thing? And is more compliance the answer? I mean, obviously, you know, you see the headlines from whoever the new state government, I don't know who it was, whether it was the person relevant in charge of the construction portfolio and related or whether it was just someone in the new state government, I can't remember. But, you know, of course, like we need more regulation is the answer, but there's more like you kind of go, but it's so heavily regulated as it stands. So how does this happen? And is more regulation really the answer? I'm a bit skeptical as to whether more regulation would have resolved this. I thought I'd put it to you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a very interesting point, to be honest, because as you say, we saw all this with the Opal Tower a few years ago, and that obviously introduced all the Class 2 legislation, which
nobody understands.
No. You know, obviously, for everyone at home, you know, Class 2 registration just means that, you know, if you do any work on the an apartment building, you need to be registered with the government to do that work. And to be registered with the government, you have to go through a whole series of checks.
Yeah. Like if anyone's still not sure what class two is, whenever you have one apartment above another, it's class two. You know, that's probably the simplest definition. So they're not townhouses in a row, but the minute you build one living space above another person's living space, that becomes class two. So residential towers, mid and even medium rise apartments, yeah, class two essentially. And yeah, based on our experience with, I mean, Opal Tower wasn't the worst one. I mean, the infamous Mascot Towers.
The Mascot Towers was definitely worse. I think it was just an unfortunate, it was in the media's focus of attention at that point in time, and that didn't help things. But, I mean, to answer your question, Matt, I don't know if further legislation is necessarily going to fix the problem because I think there's enough constraints in place as it is that, you know, things should be avoided. It just comes down to, was this just simply a series of unfortunate events that should not have taken place, or, things were missed during the certification process? It's very hard to tell. But I think really ways to avoid this is really just have a good project team on board, for starters. I mean, that's the basis for everything, really. As long as you have a solid foundation, so in this case, a good engineer, a good architect, a good builder, really you find that a lot of those issues don't tend to happen. That's my opinion on it.
Yeah, I know as a licensed builder, as a license holder for a company, you can't be everywhere and see everything. So, like, it's just not possible to make sure that every last wall tie goes in. It's just not practical unless you're a one-man sort of company and you build one house at a time, then you can be sure that everything's done right. But practical purposes, most building companies will do, multiple projects to sustain themselves, but you just can't be everywhere at once. So you have to rely on people who get it right. And I think that's been, like, whenever it comes to risk management for Ballast Point, my company, it's having good, qualified, experienced people who know that wall ties need to be installed and ring the alarm bell. And sure, I do visit site and as the license holder and check things, but you can't check every last thing under every last brick, right? It's just impossible. So I agree with your take on it. It's the team. And I found it really intriguing that it was, because I thought to myself, well, who is normally responsible for making sure that the wall ties are in? And in brick veneer, the bricks would have been laid after the timber framing is done normally. So I assume that's happened. And if there's one trade that has been impossible to get hold of in the last 12 months in Sydney, it's bricklayers. I don't know where they've all gone. I've said to a few people, I think maybe they're hiding in a like some metro tunnel building feature walls for Sydney Metro or the new freeway, and they've just been locked down there and you can't find. But if there's one trade that has been a huge headache to get hold of, it's bricklayers. So I'm wondering whether someone, and it had we found it so hard to get a bricklayer. We waited 4 months on one project for a bricklayer, and the thought occurred to me to train someone else, train some laborers to lay bricks, but we of course I didn't do that. That I realized very quickly that was not a good solution. But I'm wondering who the bricklayer was and whether this poor builder was stuck in a place where he had to deliver, bricklayers just are, I don't know where they are. They're gone. They're elsewhere. And I wonder whether that's part of it. You just can't find, and in Sydney at the moment, some trades are just impossible to get hold of.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've touched on a good point there, you know, the quality of the trades and just how difficult in some cases it still is to get those people in. I think another point to reference is, I mean, depending on when the house was built, it does look quite new. There was a shortage on a lot of building supplies back during the pandemic. Even on, I remember talking to a builder and providing details for alternative brick ties because they couldn't get the ones that we had specified on the project. And, you know, the ones we specified were by no means, you know, bespoke products or, you know, anything like that. It was just a common MET type tie and they couldn't get it. So we then had to do a bit of research and find something else. So you've also got to wonder, did that play a part as well? Whoever built the brick wall, you know, as you say, first off, were they aware that that needed to happen? And even, you know, were they able to get the brick ties in the first place? You know, was it also a decision of, oh, we'll just forego them in this section of wall? We've put them everywhere else, but we won't put them in this wall because we've run out. You know, it's a bit of an interesting one, actually, and to see whether there was a compromise made in that section of the building. Yeah, so it'd be interesting to find out what goes on.
And we must say it's highly speculative on our part, and
yeah,
and we're hardly construction gone wrong investigators. I guess we're maybe we're taking two and two and creating five, but maybe it's just someone who was lazy. We don't know, but certainly like it's not out of the question. I mean, and there's such variability in construction. You know, the thing that most people don't understand, most aspiring home builders or whoever's setting out that maybe hasn't built something before, they kind of think, well, if I've got an engineer who's registered, or, you know, if I've got an architect who's registered and I've got an engineer and I've got, you know, and I've documented everything precisely and everyone's licensed and everyone's qualified, that means I'm going to get a good job, like, because it's all documented, it's all there on the drawing. So of course I'm going to get a good job. And they don't realize just the variance between one builder and another, like the huge gap of competence, experience. It's insane what two people will do with the same set of drawings for a start, let alone the quality of the drawing itself. And I guess I've seen such variability in workmanship. It's incredible. And sometimes even within Australian standard, a lot of things that are within Australian standard, I wouldn't touch. Like, for example, and I don't know the exact dimensions, but a 600 by 300 mil tile can have a 3 mil bow in it and still be within Australian standard. And you're like, well, you can't lay that properly. My tiler won't touch it. And yet you send it back and the supplier says, well, it's within Australian standard. And you're like, yeah, but I can't lay it properly. Like, and I don't know if it's 3 mil or 4 mil, but I just, so maybe I'm misquoting and I should check my facts, but I won't. But I know, all I know is that, you know, you can be within the Australian standard and still end up with a product that you can hardly use to create a good straight wall of tiles, you know. So I think I'm always surprised at the variability. But I'm wondering if that's reflected in your experience as well in terms of inspecting things that have been executed on site.
Yeah, definitely. Like I think especially for structural engineering, the codes are very rigid, and if anything, I can safely say they've become more conservative over the years. A perfect example of that would be footings. You know, I know that the design of footings has gotten a lot more conservative in the last 10 to 15 years, and obviously you just got to look at it and go, well, that's a good thing in a way, you know, because that's just the code making sure that the structure is more rigid and it's less prone to cracking. But of course, at the end of the day, when you take a step back, the codes are in place for a almost like a one-size-fits-all solution. And obviously with residential structures, you know, they vary so much, and you come across various situations where, you know, you need to find the solution based on that code that's trying to accommodate everything. And I think really when it comes to things like what you were saying about laying tiles and stuff, you know, I think really people need to take a step back and go, okay, I know that the code says this, but in this case, I need to take it to, you know, the next level. So in that case, you know, if just say that was on the underside of a first floor or something, you know, obviously it needs to be brought up during the design phase, and the engineer is responsible for just ensuring that, you know, that the floors are designed for even less deflection. I think just saying, oh, it's designed to Australian standards, though that's a good thing in practice, I think it's even better if we just take the time and refine the design to make situations like that easier. And that's really what happens when you get a good engineer and architects on board, you know, people who are identifying these things earlier on, so that when things start on site, you know, it's an easier job for the builder, but also less potential defects, you know, because I can imagine tiling on something like that must have had a few defects further down the track. So I think that's quite important.
Yeah, I think the point I was making, though, is from what you've designed on your drawings, there's variability in how people interpret those drawings and what they do with them. And maybe structural engineering is a lot tighter, but certainly, for example, with windows, like people just think they're getting commercial grade windows, but there's so many variances in a set of windows, and it's how you finish them, it's how you craft them as well. That's important. Hack them together and screw them together, or you could have a custom extrusion that means that everything's neat and aligned and perfect, or you can just use off the shelf bits and pieces and put it. Oh my God, he's disappeared. James is gone. All over. I hope he's back.
Oh, sorry, the whole thing just went completely dead.
Oh, that's all right. He's back.
Sorry,
you're
about
back.
That.
That's all right. That was funny because it made like this sound, and you were just gone. Just like straight out of Star Trek or something. I don't know where we were up to, but
we're talking about the windows and glazing.
Oh, the window, I don't remember. Maybe
commercial glazing.
Maybe that was a sign. Shut up about the windows. But anyway, I think where I was heading was that just the variability in workmanship and outcomes from drawings that are the same, like same drawings, but you know, give them to two different builders, two different window contractors, two different bricklayers, you'll have very different outcomes. But I guess what you're saying is, well, with structure, it's either compliant or it's not, and the engineer always signs off, right?
That's it, yeah. And, you know, it's our job really to catch a lot of things. And you hear some stories, or I've heard a few stories. You can tell me your thoughts, Matt, but I've heard a few stories from other builders who've had certifiers come out to have a look at various stages of the build. They're only there for 2 minutes. They come out, they just do a very quick look, and then they're gone. And sometimes they'll do this while I'm on site having a look at something, and I could be there for, you know, close to an hour checking everything, you know, because at the end of the day, you're signing your name, your company against that piece of paper saying, yes, this has all been built in accordance with what we have designed and detailed on our drawings. So when something happens, you're liable pretty much.
Yeah, look, I agree. I've had the same experience. I mean, I think things are changing with the regulation around certifiers, but certainly 10 years ago, maybe you saw a certifier at the end of the job for 5 minutes and that's the first time you met them. But those certifiers are no longer in business, obviously. But it's not unusual. And of course, if you build a spectacular property, they're more interested in the barbecue and the view, and hardly even engaged in the building itself. They're looking around, going, oh, wow, this is amazing. I love what you built. And you kind of go, you're not really doing your job. But, you know, and inevitably those guys are out of business at some point because things catch up with them. But yeah, I think things are changing. I mean, it used to be the Wild West in terms of certifiers and the good. there was a joke in construction circles where the best, you know, the really good certifiers, you better get your building signed off quickly, otherwise, because they're going to be gone soon. The guys that were quite lenient and easy to work with were the guys who you probably you're lucky to get to the end of the build with, because it's only a matter of time till things catch up with them. But yeah, I think it's a lot. It's a different environment. Things that you used to get away with, you can't. I mean, I've had clients in the past who have built things one way while having a amendment to a DA on a parallel track next to that, and then as long as the two combine at the end. One way or another, it was fine to diverge from plans. As long as you had an amendment in council, you could run the risk. Whereas at the moment, unless you've got a, you know, they've ratcheted that right up. So you can't, if you build something that isn't approved, you'll be asked to get a building certificate for it separately to the DA. So it's quite different. And certainly I've seen a big shift in that. But, I think you're never going to catch everything. And I think, like, I mean, one of my experiences is helping a client who had a bit of a failed building experience, and we kind of came to fix a few things, add a few things. And it was a client who I spoke to pre-tender, and this is going back a bit, this is before I even had my own business, but we spoke to this client at tender stage. We submitted a price, but we didn't get the job. And I remember sort of they called us after, which is fine. Like I some builders get a bit precious about that, but I was totally fine. I was happy to help them in any way I could. I didn't mind that they went down a different path. But I went there and I knew that the other builder was quite a lot cheaper. The price was a lot less. And I looked around the job and it didn't look that bad. They did a good job, you know, like I didn't, on the surface, you couldn't see much different. But one of the jobs they asked us to do was to install an extra door that wasn't on the original plan. And that seemed like a simple enough thing, except that when my carpenter started installing it, he rang me, of course, because he said, I'm having a bit of a problem here. Because the wall's out of plumb. I'm like, well, just adjust. And he's like, well, if I adjusted that, it's also out of square. And like it just seemed like, so we're like, well, whichever way we tried to adjust it, it was, so it became a, you know, and a simple job became a difficult job because nothing was square, plumb, or level. But we eventually did that. And then I got another phone call from the same client saying, look, we've got a bit of a problem. Our sewer's blocked, and they were apologetic. They said, look, it's not your problem, I know, but can you help us? And so I rang my plumber. He sent the water jet guy, and the water jet guy went. And then I got another call from the plumber, and he's like, got a bit of a problem here, and we're sort of we've tried to water jet it, but we're hitting dirt. And next thing, he rings me like some hours later. I was on another job, and he said, "Oh, we've got a bit of an issue." Anyway, they've dug up the whole front yard. There's four plumbers there digging the whole place up because the sewer connection was at the bottom of a deep planter bed where the front yard was leveled up. So it was way down, and the sewer had never been connected. And I go, how can that possibly be? Because of all the trades, plumbing is most regulated. That gets inspected. And my plumber goes, the inspector only comes to one of every two inspections. You know, you don't know which one he's going to come to. And so things do happen, and they're always going to slip. It's impossible to see everything. It's impossible to be everywhere. But I think that, you know, my recommendation, my takeaway is like really have a good qualified, experienced, reputable team, right down to the plumber, bricklayer, and you know, because you'd kind of go, well, it's just bricks. Like, what's the problem? You know, it's just bricks, and anyone can lay bricks, right? I can lay bricks. You can maybe lay bricks. I've seen it done. I've got a trowel, like, but it's not that I.
And I mean, look, my point of view is exactly that. You know, with structural engineering, you know, we get phone calls from people too saying, "Look, sorry, you missed out on this job because you know you were more expensive than the other engineer." Or they'll ring up when they're comparing fee quotes and they go, you know, why are you more than the other engineer who sent me a quote for this job? And really the thing I have to explain to clients all the time is, you know, our fees are a reflection of how much time we're going to spend on the job. So if we look at the job and we look at the architectural drawings to figure out what we believe the design's going to be, you know, we're factoring in how much, not only engineering, but how much time we have to spend on the drawings, you know. And if there's what we believe, there's critical details that need to be, you know, drawn and sectioned on the plan, we're allowing to have those details done, you know, because we feel like that's critical that the builder knows this is what we want to happen here, you know. And it's obviously a decision that we want to pass on to you just so that, you know, the builder knows this is a critical junction in the whole structure. So we want this size plate, this size bolts. We want the beams configured in this way. And if it's a existing structure, you know, we'll put clouds on part of the drawing saying, you know, confirm what's happening here, confirm what's happening at the back of the existing structure in this location. And that's obviously the whole point of it, really. You know, you're trying your best to communicate whatever aspects of the design that you need attention for to the builder. And obviously those things take time, and you know, sometimes going with that cheaper trade, whether it's an engineer or a plumber or an electrician or a builder, there's the potential that those things are going to be missed purely because of that cost basis. So, and it comes down to exactly what you said, where, you know, the client thinks that they're getting a huge saving because, oh, we've gone with that cheaper trade there. But in actual fact, what ends up happening is exactly as you say. You've got four plumbers out in the backyard trying to locate where a sewer was plumbed in. And, you know, we hear about that all the time. And obviously that's what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah, and engineering, like, there's a multiplier effect because, like, so I've worked with different engineers. I've worked with the cut price engineers and I've worked with you guys, and I think there's a few things that happens in cost effective engineers. One thing is they do get a bit lazy with their drawings. So sometimes it's not even a matter of the fact that they're going to design something that's going to fall down. But if they're a bit lazy, they can cost you tens of thousands of dollars. So you might save a couple of thousand dollars in fees. But if they're not designing efficiently, they might design in a whole bunch of structure that you actually don't need. And there's a saying in scouts or outdoors, if you can't tie knots, just tie lots. And I have seen this. I have seen an engineer drawing what is a typical detail, and you're kind of going, why is this here? What is it holding up? And kind of go, oh, yeah, okay, this detail is for the cantilever or something that's particular to that end of the building. They've extended it all the way through just because they're lazy. You don't need an extra, 2 ton of steel and X cubes of concrete. Why is this like this? And it's obviously for that end of the building where it's needed. They've just drawn a typical detail all the way through. And I've actually seen it and pointed out this in a job that I've done in Bondi where I'm like, why is it? What is going on with this footing? This is just obscene. And it's just a continuation of the footing at one end that was supporting something pushed all the way through the whole building just because they were lazy. It could have easily been something that sort of swapped from being oversized to being undersized, where as required, it was all sitting on rock. It wasn't going to fly away. So I'm kind of going, yeah, there's a saving there. They're a cost-effective engineer, but they've cost this client's tens of thousands of dollars just through their, just for not producing enough drawings and thinking through the process. And exactly. I've seen this. Needed, yeah. So not, yeah, most buildings don't fall over, but yeah, you do. Smart engineers can save multiples of their fee by engineering things efficiently, I've found. So that's something that certainly should be factored in.
So the key point there, Matt, that you brought up is on the engineering, you question the design element, right? I think that's brilliant. As far as I'm concerned, the builders are on site the whole time. They're actively looking at the structure. They're taking into account all the various factors that can change the conditions of the engineering. And I think it's key that there's a good relationship there with the engineer, to take into account those things. And if there is a better way of doing things or a more cost-effective way of doing things, especially nowadays where construction materials have gone up, if there's a way that we can pass a saving on to the client while ensuring that structurally everything's fine, then that's really the best possible way of constructing a house nowadays,
The question that people have asked, my wife's brought up, that several people have mentioned is how do I know if my house is going to collapse? How do I know? How can I? Because this house looked like it was a new build. So yeah, I think it was built 6 to 12 months ago. It's a new house. It's obviously had an engineer involved. It looked really good. How can people know that their house that they're looking to buy or that they've just had built, what are the red flags? How do they know that their house is not in danger of collapsing? Because it looked good from the outside, looked good on the real estate photos, I'm sure.
Well, that kind of falls into two categories, and the first I'd say is if you're looking to buy a new house, so you're in the market and you're looking to buy something, if you see something that doesn't look right, contact an engineer, right? And it's like anything, it may cost a little bit to have an engineer to come out and inspect something compared to tens of thousands of dollars after you've bought it and you've just ignored the problem and now you've got to get it all fixed, right? So an engineer can very quickly save you the expense of purchasing a house that has lots of structural issues, really. That's the first thing I would recommend. If you're looking at purchasing a apartment unit, so a unit in a big block of apartment blocks, and I would say that the best thing to do there is to see if you can track down who the original structural engineer was. You know, with those blocks of units, you tend to find that if you just call some random engineer in to come and have a look, they're not going to be able to give you a 100% defined answer as to if there's a problem or not. Your best method is to go to try and track down the engineer who originally designed it, because if there is a crack or some type of defect in the place, the good chances are they've got the documentation on hand, the design's already been looked through and thought out, and they should be able to give you a much better quality answer. So I always recommend that with the apartment buildings, but with the older houses, try and find an engineer that's local, you know, that's familiar with the area, familiar with the style of houses, and that way they can give you the answer straight up front as to if there's a problem or not. And I think that's the critical thing when buying a house. When you own the house, it's a bit different. Obviously, to all the homeowners, I just say, keep an eye on your house, really. You walk past that crack in the wall every day. You know, if it's getting bigger, keep track of it. You know, does it, when it rains, does it close up? You know, does it open up again? Is it getting bigger? You know, if it starts getting bigger, definitely call an engineer.
Yeah, and I don't think normally things just don't spectacularly fail. Like that, there's normally you do get some warning, like you do get some cracking, some movement. Like, so I think if you have a new house, I mean, like it's very normal. Like the hard thing for most people is knowing what to worry about. I mean, it's not unusual to get some shrinkage cracks or some cracking of plasterboard or things as things dry out. They can crack. So plasterboard cracking is probably more problematic. But I think like it's very unusual for things just to fall over suddenly. Like I would have expected at that house, and it'd be interesting to read about it one day after it's investigated, but I'm almost certain there would have been something odd happening, something odd. Boeing, the garage door not closing properly, there would have been something that just wasn't quite right. And like all accidents, you know, like I mean, I've got some reference points from like reading about outdoor accidents and or whether it's a plane crash investigation or whether it's a rock climbing accident or a mountaineering accident. It's normally a combination of things that build off of each other and compound, and then some little thing that normally is quite normal becomes the thing that tips the whole balance. But I'm not sure how you feel, James, but I think there would have been some odd things happening in that house where it's new and yet there's something not quite right. I mean, maybe time will prove me wrong. That's fine. Happy to be proved wrong. But I think there would have been a few things that are just on and awkward and just not feeling right. And yeah, I think an engineer would have said, yeah, there's something's not right. I think you would have probably picked up on the fact that something wasn't working.
Exactly. That's right. And I agree with you. I think it would have been a number of things to occur for that type of failure to take place on the building. But yeah, look, in terms of the red flags to look out for, you know, as you were saying, in terms of cracking, you know, hairline cracks, so, you know, very minute, very thin cracks, that type of stuff we don't worry about. That's more a cosmetic type of crack. It's when you start to have the cracks that you can fit your hands through. They're the ones that, you know, you definitely need to get a structural engineer out. The other things too, it may not completely have to do with the structure itself. You know, it could be what's surrounding the structure, you know. So, you know, is there unexpectedly large volumes of water moving past the existing footings of the building, you know, from, say, a burst water main or something, you know, because obviously those type of things are going to wash away the foundations and that can cause settlement in the footings. Even there was an issue, I think it was last year in Bondi, there was a neighbouring house that collapsed due to a building excavation that was right next to it. And there wasn't adequate shoring. I don't know if you remember that one, Matt, but
yep, no, definitely do.
Yeah, and obviously you can see from the photos it just wasn't adequate shoring along the boundary, especially in sand. And there was, as a result, the neighbor's house fell into that excavation. So there's just a lot of things to look out for.
Yeah. But there's always something, there's water, like there's a lot of water that's unexpected. There's always something that's quite odd. And I think, like, if I was to say anything to someone in a new house, thinking of buying a new house, like, you really, yeah, get, I agree, get, I mean, not everyone will get a structural engineer to inspect, but certainly get someone who's an experienced builder or at the very least a building and pest inspection. And if there's some anomalies that come out in that building and pest inspection, certainly you should look into it further before buying. I guess the other thing that should be mentioned is that, I guess, it, as unfortunate and painful as it is, I guess there isn't an insurance in place for every new build and every renovation. And in New South Wales, that covers an amount of damage. So if you are a homeowner or you are a building company, well, make sure they're licensed and insured, definitely. Make sure that they've taken out a policy, which is the Home Building Compensation Fund policy, which every builder should have in place. And it's easily searchable online to see who is a license holder, who is an insurance holder. So yeah, I think that certainly helps a lot in, you know, we don't want anything to fall over, but there are safeguards in place already to prevent that and compensate people. Even if their builder is no longer around, then they still have access to financial compensation to help rebuild. But yeah, anything to add, James? And then we'll probably just go into 3 key takeaways. Any last comments?
So I guess, I mean, just touching on what you said, we all have to have insurances in place. And obviously the investigation that will be occurring on that house in Condell Park at the moment, you know, they'll be going through all forms of documentation, you know, the structural engineers' documentation, the architects, all the builders' emails, all of that, trying to work out what happened and why. And, you know, obviously it's not something that the clients should pay for because, you know, like anything, you build a house, you expect it to be structurally sound and built in accordance with the standards. So to have something like this happen, it just means something most likely wasn't built to the standards. And it's just identifying what that was and who took the shortcut, I guess, so to speak. Not pointing fingers at anyone, but, you know, it's all speculation, as you say. But, yeah, see what happens.
So my key takeaway is okay, firstly, if you're building a house, get a good design team, a good construction team, get a good bricklayer, and if you have to wait 4 months. Don't compromise on those things. I mean, it's tough sometimes because all you want to do is get your clients in, and yeah, it's a struggle sometimes. But I guess we always have that conversation with our clients to say, hey, look, we're a bit stuck. We've really made an effort to find people, but there's a bit of a wait, and there's there's not, most clients prefer to wait and, you know, as long as you're up front, you're not just stuffing them around playing games, they're on board. They choose to wait and they go, well, we want a good job. That's their first and foremost. And you just go, well, I'm sorry, but that Tyler or that person is just not available and we can't find a suitable replacement. You know, most people wait. So be patient and wait for qualified, use qualified people, experienced people. It makes all the difference. I guess the second takeaway is things don't normally just fall in a heap. So don't ignore the warning signs. If things aren't right, get some advice. If things don't feel right, things aren't, yeah, like I said, I'm wondering, yeah, what were the telltale signs? Something, yeah, a lot of the time things do move, things slip and move, and they don't just spectacularly implode. Like it's normally you see it's cracking, you see movement, something's not right, and then before that collapse, you do see things that are changing and moving. It's very unusual for things to spontaneously collapse. So that's something that, you know, you can be assured most houses, and it's so rare. I mean, of the hundreds of thousands of houses built, you know, the odd one collapses. So your house is probably going to be fine. James, anything to add to those sort of takeaways, sort of to round it all out? Bring us home, James.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just touching on your last point there, you know, to everyone that's listening to this podcast and, you know, concerned about their own house, you know, the codes that we design to obviously have a lot of tolerances built into them nowadays. So if the code says you have to have a, you know, 200 mil thick slab, you know, technically speaking, you could get away with less, but the code takes into account various contingencies, you know, really for the longevity of the structure, but also for people's safety. So, you know, people shouldn't be worried that things are going to occur to your house, but as we touched on before, you are in charge of monitoring your house. You know, just watch any new cracks that may appear, keep an eye on what's going on around your property. You know, if there's a construction site next door, you know, and they're doing a rather deep excavation, you know, make sure that everything's been done properly. And when in doubt, ask a professional for advice, because most of the time, all those concerns that you may have, there may not really be anything wrong at all. It's just the building moving, which is completely normal. And I think really that's all you can do as a homeowner. So keep an eye on it. And obviously if anything comes up, just give someone a call if you've got something wrong and we'll go from there.
Yeah, and don't panic. I mean, things shrink. Concrete shrinks. Clay bricks grow over time while concrete shrinks away. Timber shrinks. Steel grows when it's hot, you know. Steel grows in length, and then when it's cold, it shortens. And timber probably does the opposite because it gets damp when it's cold and it expands. So things do move around. Like it's probably not the end of the world if something's moving. But just get it. Yeah, don't just sit there and hope for the best. Get it checked out. So thank you, James. So James Rutherford is from Structure, just giving you a little plug there. And Structure is in Roselle, just down the street from us. And James, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me on, Matt. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning into Buildopedia. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating to help other listeners like you find our podcast. For more information, please check out the show notes and connect with us on social media. We would love to hear from you.